Senate Labor and Commerce Committee, the Senate's Committee on the Economy. Today is March 28th. It is 1:30 in the afternoon. This is our afternoon meeting for the day. I'd like to welcome Senator Gardner. Welcome. And I expect the other members to be joining us shortly. Also, I'd like to thank the recording secretary and the LIO operator, Carrie and Tom. Thank you for your assistance. We will not hear Senate Bill 51 today, but we will continue with the governor's appointees to state boards and commissions. And so with that, I'd like to begin with the Board of Professional Counselors. This is a five-member board, and we will be hearing from Deborah Hamilton of Soldotna, who's the licensed professional counselor appointee for that seat. And with that, we'll go ahead and get started. As I mentioned with all of our appointees, we certainly appreciate the willingness for Alaskans to serve, and this also represents one of the only opportunities for the legislature to interact with the appointees. So with that, Deborah, if you're online and can hear me, please feel free to introduce yourself to the committee and express your interest in serving. Okay. So we don't have her online. Is Ann Brainerd Marco of Fairbanks online? This is the licensed professional counselor seat. Okay. I'm going to go to the Real Estate Commission because I can see that David Pruse is online. And give me a moment here to move to that area of the agenda. So, Mr. Pruse, welcome. Thank you for making yourself available. This is the Real Estate Commission. It's a seven-member board, and this is the fourth judicial district seat where Mr. Pruse has been appointed by the governor. And Mr. Pruse, if you could introduce yourself to the committee and let us know why you're interested in serving.
David Pruse, born and raised here in Fairbanks. I am 57 years old. I have had a career in real estate one way or another since 1982. I graduated from California Polytechnic State University with a degree in business administration with a concentration in real estate and finance. In 1982, I started my professional career as a real estate appraiser, commercial and residential here in Fairbanks. I have been a licensee in the state of Alaska since 1989, getting my associate broker in 1995 and my broker's license in 2001. I also have a license in real estate instruction and will be coming within 30 to 90 days, depending on the review process. I will have a class of pre-licensing, a 40-hour course. And so far, I've got about 300 hours in the process of getting that 40 hours done. I've been on the Fairbanks Rochester Borough Planning Commission, not anymore, from 2007 to 2014, being the chairman of the Planning Commission for 2 years. I was on the Board of Equalization with the Fairbanks Rochester Borough for 7 years, and that's the board that hears disputes of real estate valuation between the taxpayer and the Fairbanks Rochester Borough Assessor's Office. And I'm a current member of the City of Fairbanks City Council, elected in 2014.
Great. Thank you very much. Mr. Pruse, I just wanted to bring up one issue, and that is something I've spoken directly with the department and also the chair of the Real Estate Commission. But about 10 years ago, the legislature made some changes to statutes related to governing real estate licenses, and we did away with the surety fund and set a requirement that the Real Estate Commission adopt an errors and omissions insurance policy for licensees. And as you know, we're coming up on we're rounding the corner on the deadline for that, and I was wondering if you had any thoughts about how we can ensure that a situation like this doesn't happen again, because it's been causing a lot of stress in the industry. And I know I've spoken to constituents also who are very concerned that the state's not going to meet its deadline that we put out in statute. So did you want to comment on that?
Certainly, Senator Costello. I've had a E&O policy since I started. I've always had one. And when I was asked what two things I would do if I was on the real estate commission, I said I would look at the E&O policy and use the every 2 years when a broker updates his license as a way to do an audit and have a space on there for the broker to put his E&O policy on. That way, when Sharon Walsh and Nancy Harris down at the Real Estate Commission are putting in the licensees for the upgrades or updates, they can see that they have an E&O policy there, and they can do spot audits as they do on the educational requirements for a licensee right now. So that was one of the two things that I thought they should do.
Thank you for responding to that. Are there other questions of committee members for Mr. Pruse? Senator Gardner.
Thank you. I think I'm having a hard time following. I don't understand what we can do to help those part-time broker or licensees who can't afford the costs of the E&O policies that we're requiring of them.
Senator, through the chair, Senator Costello, Senator Gardner, it is the real estate broker who must have the E&O policy. Even though everyone underneath him is an independent contractor, he is the broker, the company owner, and he is the one who must and should have the E&O policy. So when you're auditing, all you need to do is make sure the broker has an E&O policy in place for his real estate company, and the other licensees are underneath that insurance policy.
Thank you. I think that will come as a relief to some of my constituents. Does every licensee work under a broker?
Yes.
Thank you.
I'd also like to welcome Senator Meyer. Good afternoon. Vice Chair Senator Hughes, welcome, and Senator Stevens, who have now joined us. Is there anybody here in the room or online who wishes to provide any public testimony on David Pruse and the Real Estate Commission? Okay. Seeing none, Mr. Pruse, thank you very much. Appreciate your willingness to serve and certainly your availability this afternoon to come before the committee.
Thank you very much, Senator Costello. It is my honor and a wonderful privilege. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Next, also with the Real Estate Commission, the nominee is Guy Mickle with, calling in from Ketchikan. And Guy, if you could please introduce yourself to the committee and express to us why you're interested in serving.
Yes, good afternoon. My name is Guy Mickle. I am a lifetime Ketchikan resident. I've had a real estate license since 1987. And actually, I was asked by a current commission member if I would consider applying for the commission, and I talked to the people I work with and my family, and I decided that I thought I could be of service to the state, so I applied.
Great. Thank you very much. Do any committee members have any questions for Guy? Okay, seeing none, it looks like you got off pretty easy there. Is there anyone here in Juneau or online who wishes to testify on the nomination of Guy Mickle to the Real Estate Commission? Okay, seeing none, thank you very much. Thank you for your willingness to serve.
Thank you.
So members, the next board that we will go to is the Board of Direct Entry Midwives. And this is a five-member board, and we will be hearing from three nominees to this board. The first one is Catherine Ostrom of Anchorage. Catherine, can you hear me?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay. And actually, my document here says that you're calling in from Homer.
Correct.
Thank you. So if you could introduce yourself to the committee and share with us why you're interested in serving, and also perhaps explain any challenges that you think that the board will be addressing in the near future.
Wonderful. Thank you, Senators. My name is Catherine Ostrom, and I've been an OBGYN in Alaska since 2006. When I first arrived, I did move to Anchorage, and I worked for Alaska Native Medical Center for 3 years. And then I joined private practice in Anchorage for 7. And then in the last year, I've been the OBGYN in Homer, Alaska as a full-time OBGYN here. When I was in Anchorage over the last 2 or 3 years, we started a laborist program at Providence, which is an OBGYN on staff at all times. And when I started that program, it was a wonderful way to work with our lay midwives in the community because we were a resource for them if they had any patients that needed a little bit of extra care during the labor process. So it was a really wonderful introduction to our community here that takes care of moms and babies with low-risk home births and births in birth centers. So also in private practice, I would take direct referrals from some of the direct entry midwives in town. Now, when I moved to Homer a year ago, I knew that I was going to work with certified nurse midwives in my full-time job, but I also knew that the small community of direct entry midwives that are in Homer, that I could be a direct referral source for them and consultant. And so I have to say that I really enjoy that part of it because those low-risk moms that are, you know, having a wonderful prenatal care, and then when they get to the birth process, they just need a little bit of extra help. It's really wonderful to walk them through that process because it is scary to go from a home birth to then need help in a hospital. So I have to say that was the impetus for me to apply to the board when there was an opening because I've had a lot of experience working with direct entry midwives, and I really enjoy that type of patient and helping them transition to a hospital, but only if needed. Some of the issues that we're going to be addressing mainly include, and we want to build our numbers in the state, and we have a really good base of almost 50 midwives, but we are losing some midwives to the fact that the licensing fees are quite hefty. In fact, they're very high for a licensed professional to have, and one of the reasons for that is because we do have some investigative processes that have cost, the investigations have cost quite a bit of money that's coming from our board. For anyone who might come to this state and do a home delivery for a patient, that is just not acceptable, but we are responsible for investigating those cases. And that's taking quite a bit out of our budget, and that was one of the reasons that the licensing fees for our group went up. And this past year, we lost about 13 applicants. Either due to retirement for some of them, but most of them could not make those licensing fees. So I think that's a big issue that we're going to see the repercussions of in this next year.
Thank you, Dr. Ostrom. So it's my understanding that the board is dealing with an operating deficit. And do you know the amount of the deficit? And then could you also share with the committee members your current licensing fee amount?
Oh, sure. So I hope I get this correct. The licensing fee right now, I believe, is around $3,800. And that was quite an increase from before, and I think some of my other colleagues who are online for appointment may know the details a little bit more because they would be paying those directly themselves. And then I think you had a separate part of the question.
Yes, the board is currently operating at
The deficit.
Deficit, yes.
I believe the deficit is somewhere around $60,000. It's quite large. It's been growing over the last couple of years. So I don't have the exact numbers in front of me, but it's, I believe, somewhere in the $60,000 range.
Thank you. And back to your licensing fee, is that every 2 years that fee is due?
Correct.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. Are there questions from committee members? Okay. Senator Hughes?
The deficit that you mentioned, what is the plan to eliminate that?
Well, the good news is we do have a number of apprentices that are working in the state, about 16 apprentices, so we hope to bring up our numbers by keeping those apprentices here in the state once they've graduated their program. The other is that we have, we're trying to cut costs for our meetings. We now do teleconference instead of meeting in person, so all the travel fees, that will bring us down about $5,000 a year if we meet by teleconference. And that, for right now, that is currently our plan for now.
Senator Hughes.
Thank you. Just a quick, just one more quick one, Madam Chair. Is any of the deficit, or are you finding that you're having to do investigations for people who are not licensed, that are not paying fees, or is that not a factor
Correct.
Of your board?
Correct.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
Dr. Ostrom, could you clarify that response? You said that the reason is because you're doing investigations related to individuals who are not licensed?
Correct. So individuals who are not licensed in the state of Alaska come here and practice, and then that case needs to be investigated, but they're not, they've never been licensed in the state, and it doesn't go to the nurse midwifery group or the physician group. It goes directly to the Board of Direct Entry Midwives for anything that happens in a home or birth center from a provider who's from out of state.
Okay, thank you for that. Senator Gardner has a question.
Thank you. I have a little bit of curiosity about the conflict of interest on your statement or application form.
Yes.
It says certain boards and commissions require disclosure of personal financial data. If you're required for the board or commission for which you're applying, are you willing to do so? And you said no. And I've been checking. I actually don't know if this board or commission requires that. Do you know if it does?
Oh, I don't know, and I have to say I am not familiar with having said no to that question.
Okay.
The application. I don't have anything not to disclose.
Okay, and this may be something similar, if I might, Madam Chair. The next question is, could you or any member of your family be affected financially by decisions made by the board or commission for which you were applying? And you said yes. Then it said, please explain the potential financial benefit, and you said no. Is this just kind of mixed signals here?
It is. I'm so sorry. I do remember the first application I sent through, I was having trouble with my computer, and so I am surprised that that is the answer online, because I would have said no. There should be no direct.
Okay. Thank you.
Or anything to family.
Thank you, Senator Gardner, for the question. I'm just thinking out loud if perhaps Dr. Ostrom has an opportunity to resubmit an accurate application, just because we do read the applications and we do look at the resumes, and there are so many very talented Alaskans really who stepped up to the plate. So I want to thank you for that. Is there anyone here in the room or online who would like to provide public testimony related to this appointee? Okay, seeing none. Thank you, Catherine. I appreciate your making yourself available.
Thank you. I'll go ahead and resubmit the application.
Okay. Next, I'd like to invite Dana Brown, also with the Board of Direct Entry Midwives. Dana, if you could introduce yourself to the committee, and perhaps if you've been listening to the questions, address the questions we have about the licensing fees and the effort to address the deficit. But if you have other issues you'd like to bring up to the committee, that would be fine too.
Yes, hi, this is Dana Brown from Fairbanks. I've been licensed since 1993. I was licensed with the first group of midwives ever licensed in Alaska, and I was one of the ones that helped Alaska get a licensing option for certified direct entry midwives. I was originally licensed in the state of New Mexico, which Alaska used as an example of a way to license midwives here. So I've been here a very long time. I've actually been labor sitting for someone today that we're helping with their eighth baby, all of which were born here with us. I served on the direct entry board from 2000 to 2009. And we had issues then as well with unlicensed practitioners, or unlicensed people calling themselves a midwife. And we were paying for investigation since the very beginning. There was one person that applied in the beginning that we didn't license that caused quite a, I think it ended up being $17,000 or something for that person. And then we've had a couple others you know, along the way. When I served on the board before we started getting ahead of it, and then actually got the board extended for 9 years at one point. The licensing examiner that we had, I felt, did a really good job because they did help us not start projects that we would be kept from going forward because of statute. They had a, seemed like a very good rapport with the Department of Law that made our wording go smoothly. The investigator that I worked with at, during those years, it just seemed that some investigations went through very quickly and some even got stopped because it wasn't necessary. And then when that licensing examiner got replaced with the one before the one we have now, it seems like a lot of things got changed. And I do question some of the things that went on during the time before Renee, who's our licensing examiner we have now. That person, I think, caused some of the increase in cost in just the cost associated with our board. And I saw one case where they did a regulation project that was actually brought up by the licensing examiner, and I've never seen a licensing examiner talk about our regulation projects, initiating a regulation project. And that project that they started had already been done when I was on the board, and it was shot down by the Department of Law. So that was very frustrating to me to watch these things happen. But now I do feel encouraged because the new examiner that's on seems to be doing her job well and serving more as a licensing examiner than a board member. And the board that we have right now is very strong. And looking at ways to streamline the application process and trying to have our meetings teleconference, I just flew down to Anchorage for the teleconference meeting recently and thought it went really well. I went down there because I did want to connect with the midwives. And I was a little concerned about being on a phone for that many hours because there wasn't a teleconference site here in Fairbanks. But the examiner did say that we can do that through the LIO here. Again, I don't mind traveling to Anchorage on my own either. But yeah, so I come from I've been a midwife in Alaska for 30 years and have been politically active in support of midwifery and caring about maternal health in Alaska. So I don't know if any of that helps, that background, or if you have any specific questions for me.
Thank you, Dana. And I do remember when the legislation went through to create the board, and mm-hmm. I also remember Kay Karn was a part of that effort. And it just speaks to the importance of institutional memory on our boards. Oftentimes people get reappointed, or in your case you're getting appointed again after having served in the past. So I think your experience will be helpful to the board. And Senator Hughes has a question for you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Dana, for your prior service and being willing to step up again. You know, we heard a little bit ago that the licensure fees are $3,800, and I don't know if that's the highest for any profession, but I know it's a lot higher than a lot of other professions. And that we also heard that that some of that is going to pay for investigations for unlicensed folks, and I think that's a problem that we need to address for all of the professions across the state. But was wondering if you have any ideas of how to address those, the 3,800. It sounds like there's going to be some efficiency, streamlining, travel, but if we also were able to come up with a solution to get the people who are being investigated to pay for their investigations instead of through the fees, would that bring down the cost? Are there other ways that we could bring down that cost per direct entry midwife?
I'm not totally familiar with House Bill 90, but it looks like it's trying to address the, like it would be helpful to the direct entry midwives if it was passed. And I'm not sure where that stands exactly. I think that we're on the right path right now as far as streamlining costs, and the midwives being willing to pay this big fee. And what I'm hearing amongst the midwives is they want to get it paid off so we can move forward. One of the other things that happened one time when our fees got dropped, because they've gone up and down the whole time I've been a midwife. And one time we wanted to keep them higher, but they said that we couldn't legally do that because it would be paying ahead. But we still had a big debt that we owed, but they made us lower our fees. And the midwives actually wanted to keep them up. And I don't know why we can't do that, but I guess it's just the law. I do feel like we can get this paid off and move forward, and hopefully if unlicensed, you know, another thing that happened with the investigations, though, was they got stuck. When I was on the board, our investigations moved forward, especially the ones amongst that were done on direct entry midwives. If there was a direct entry midwife that was under investigation, we moved forward with it and got it done and dealt with. And what happened in these last years was there was all these, there was a couple of different investigations that sat open for years, 4 years, 6 years, and just kept getting stuck because new investigators would come or it would just get left on someone's desk. And so the cost just kept going and going on these open cases. And so I hope that now, with investigations working to become more efficient again, we'll get any new cases worked through and then closed instead of sitting there for years and years doing nothing. I really think that the efficiency that it sounds like investigations is going to do now will bring down those costs as well.
Thank you for that.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you for your question, Senator Hughes. Certainly,
mm-hmm.
I'd be interested in looking at ways that we can help address this problem, and certainly the fluctuation of licensing fees has been something the legislature's been aware of for many of the boards, and we've seen an institution from the department of a new program that they use to try to address that problem. So it's been very informative to have you here before us today. Are there any other questions? Okay, seeing none. Is there anyone here in the room that wishes to testify on Dana Brown's appointment? Is there anyone online? Okay, seeing no one. Thank you very much, Dana.
Thank you so much.
Next, we have Catherine Roberts, also an appointee to the Board of Direct Entry Midwives. She's calling in from Anchorage. Welcome, Catherine, and please feel free to introduce yourself to the committee and express why you're interested in serving on this board.
Okay. Hi, I'm Catherine Roberts. I'm a certified nurse midwife here in Anchorage, Alaska, and I've been practicing for about 3 years. I started out in a home birth and birth center practice, and that's kind of where I got my start, was working with directly alongside direct entry midwives who taught me kind of from the ground up about out-of-hospital birth and managing that and giving that opportunity to women and families in Alaska. I now work at Alaska Native Medical Center in Anchorage. So we serve as the tertiary care center for the state here. So we get the women from the villages and the hubs that come down if needed for high risk. And we also still get transfers and transports from direct entry midwives in the community if those women are pregnant with Native babies as well. So I've actually been serving on the board for a year, a little over a year now. I finished out the term of Sarah Tagan, who was the previous nurse midwife on the board. I finished out her term because she resigned, and then they had asked that I be confirmed again, and I'm definitely still interested in continuing. I've seen the board work through a lot in the past year as far as just everything you guys have already been talking about, the finances, the deficit, trying to cut costs, scrubbing regulations, that kind of thing. And as a nurse midwife, you know, I have the ability to work in the hospital, but definitely think that our direct entry midwives and our doctors, like, we're all part of the same team. We're all part of the same cause, which is offering safe, like the safest and the most high quality maternity care that we can to the women of Alaska, and empowering those women to have the choice of where they deliver and who they want to deliver with. So I definitely think that the Board of Direct Entry Midwives is important to our state as far as self-regulating those direct entry midwives because they do such a good job with our women and families here in the state, and I hope to see it grow.
Great, thank you very much. I've been looking over your resume, and you certainly are very well qualified and bring with you a tremendous amount of experience. Are there any questions of committee members? Were you going to say that, Senator Gardner? Okay. Thank you so much, Catherine. I appreciate you making yourself available today and also for your service to the state. Is there anybody here in Juneau who wishes to testify on this nominee's appointment? Okay, is there anybody online? All right. Seeing none, thank you very much, Catherine. Next, we have the Board of Professional Counselor Appointees, and we will be hearing from Annie Brainerd Marco, calling in from Fairbanks, and give the committee members time to flip to that section of the packet. And Annie, if you could introduce yourself to the members and express to us your interest in serving on the board and any challenges that you think the board will be looking at in the coming years.
Hi, yeah, my name is Ann Brainerd Marco. I have been a licensed professional counselor for 14 years here all in the state of Alaska. I'm also an approved counselor supervisor. I finished my first round with the board and absolutely loved it. And I guess I was compelled to apply because I've worked in so many different areas of mental health here in Alaska. I was out in the rural village of Galena for 5 years and really loved that, and then came in and ran a residential treatment center for women with addictions for 1 year, and then worked with Profit, and now I'm with Hope. So lots of varied experience, lots of volunteer experience. So I thought that I could not only give a lot of professional experience to the board, but also a lot of different viewpoints from what I've done.
Thank you very much, Annie. You do have a question from Senator Gardner.
Actually, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for your service, Annie. It's not so much a question as a comment that your resume is exhausting to look at. It's just really long, lots of different things you've done. So I think you bring a variety, a really wide variation of experiences to the board. Thank you.
Thank you.
Annie, I'm also looking at materials and appreciate some with your experience being willing to serve. My question has to do with the surplus that the board is looking at. You have a surplus of $264,000, and I'm wondering if you just wanted to comment on that or perhaps explain to the committee, is there a plan, are you reducing fees in the future? Is there a plan to do that?
Absolutely. What had happened was when the audit was done back in 2013, that actually just predated me, the OPC board had thought that they were in the black about $125,000. When the audit was completed, we were found to be in the red over $125,000. So we did an initial increase in funds from 250 to, I want to say 400 or 450, that did not meet it because we renew every 2 years. We tend to have 1 year of surplus and then another kind of makeup year. So to get out of debt, we raised the fees significantly to $650 and looked at ways to get revenue so that we could get out of that deficit. Now, what we actually project is that by the end of FY17, we'll probably be at a break even. We had our renewal year in 2016, so, and we had wonderful applications, and our applications have gone up. But we don't renew this fiscal year, so I do not expect that surplus to stay at all. I'm actually quite hopeful that we're going to be break even and perhaps a tiny bit over break even.
Okay. Thank you very much for that. Is there anyone here in Juneau who wishes to testify on this nominee? Is there anybody online? Okay, seeing none, thank you for your willingness to serve. And that concludes the committee's review of boards and commissions nominees, at least those who are available for the public testimony. And for those that weren't able to call in today, we will review those again. Next, I'd like to invite the sponsor of Senate Bill 48 up to the table if Senator Keto is interested in coming forward, Representative Keto. This is the second hearing for Senate Bill 48, the Architect and Engineer Surveyors, the board extension, and just want to give the sponsor of the legislation an opportunity to provide any comments, and then we'll look to the will of the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and it is House Bill 48.
Yes.
And House Bill 48 is a basic extension of the Architects, Engineers, Land Surveyors Board, full extension of 8 years, so to 2025. The additional item we've added to this one is the installation of the landscape architect as a permanent voting member of the board. That position currently exists as a non-voting member, so the cost is already being borne by the payers of the license and registration fees for the board, and that individual is participating in all respects except voting on items that need to be voted on. So we do have about 50 landscape architects licensed now, about the same number of individuals as we have mining engineers. Mining engineers also have a dedicated or defined seat on the board as well. The board size will go in statute from 10 to 11. That's just recognizing the additional individual as a voting member as opposed to a temporary law non-voting member. So that, with that, I'm available for any questions.
Thank you, and I'll correct for the record that it's House Bill 48 and it's Representative Keto. Are there any questions for the sponsor of the bill? Okay. Seeing none, Senator Hughes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move House Bill 48 from committee with individual recommendations and the attached fiscal note.
Is there any objection to moving the bill? Okay, seeing none, we will move the bill and we'll take a brief at ease before we hear from the sponsor of Senate Bill 93. Bill 93, introduced by Senator John Coghill. I'd like to welcome Reneva Moss to present the bill. This is the first hearing for Senate Bill 93, so we'll take members' questions and take public testimony and then set the bill aside.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Reneva Moss, staff to Senator Coghill. He sends his apologies, but he got called to a meeting, so I'm going to be presenting the bill. Last year, the legislature passed Senate Bill 121, which was a security freeze for minors 18 and under. What this does is, because there's such a difference between adult security freezes and minor security freezes, this sets up a separate process for creating that freeze that will mirror 26 other states that have done the same thing. And by the way, I'm entering the 21st century. This is my first PowerPoint. So bear with me.
Congratulations.
Thank you. First of all, who is a protected consumer? It's a person who is incapacitated or a person who is 16 years of age or younger. Of course, the definition of an incapacitated person is basically a person who the court determines is unable to take care of themselves. And then you have to ask, why 16? We are reducing this from 18 to 16, but it is found in 26 other states that consumers at the age of 16 typically have begun working, they own a cell phone, they have a bank account, and therefore they have established active credit. Credit freeze for a minor and a credit freeze for an adult, while they're similar in name, they are very different. A credit freeze for a minor does not have a credit report. A credit record must be established in order for a freeze to occur. So an adult already has a credit record, and there is less verification to freeze an account for an adult. So this requires us to set up a separate system for minors. There has to be a verification, and you have to authenticate the identities of both the minor and the requester. You have to verify the relationship of the person requesting the freeze for the minor, and you have to create a new record prohibiting a credit report to be created in the future for the minor until the freeze is lifted. Section 2 of this bill creates Article 2A, Security Freeze for Protected Consumers. It sets up a system and statute for the placement of and a removal of a security freeze. It also sets up a system for verification of the parties involved. First, you have the placement of the security freeze. That's AS 4548-300. A consumer credit reporting agency is mandated to place a freeze on a protected consumer if, first of all, the protected consumer's representative requests one. Then that protected consumer's representative must submit a request as required by the independent agency, submit proof of identification of the protected consumer, submit proof of identification of the representative and proof of authority, be that court documents or what. And they must pay a fee of not more than $5. Then there has to be a creation of a record. Because the protected consumer doesn't have a credit report with the agency is required by this statute to create a record for the protected consumer and place a freeze on it. This ensures that credit is not granted in the protected consumer's name. Proof of identification and authority. Proof of identification includes Social Security number or a copy of a Social Security card, certified or official birth certificate, a driver's license or identification card issued by Department of Motor Vehicles, or other identification issued by a government agency. Proof of authority would include a court order, a written notarized statement expressly describing the authority that the representative has signed. Then there is the placement of the freeze. The agency must place a freeze on the credit record no later than 30 days after receiving the request. Unlike an adult freeze, where consumers have already been authenticated through a lender, additional steps must be taken to authenticate a child, including birth certificate parental authority. The result is a timely, manual process to appropriately protect children and safeguard them from identity theft. The freeze stays in place until the representative requests that it be lifted. Or if the freeze was placed by misrepresentation of fact, the agency can lift the freeze. The duration of the freeze remains in effect until the representative removes the freeze. And again, it could occur that the agency would lift the freeze because the freeze was placed with false information. Removal of the freeze is just as burdensome as placing a freeze. So again, it requires 30 days. It requires that the representative put in a request as required by the individual agency. And it requires that they again provide proof of identification of the protected consumer, the representative, and authority for the representative, and a fee of $5. There are times when the agency may not charge a fee. That would be when a protected consumer, a representative, submits a police report or an investigation for identity theft, or when the protected consumer the protected consumer is under the age of 16 and the agency has created a credit report for the consumer. There are agencies that are exempt from this, and in AS 4548390, we list some exemptions. These are all people who do not create credit reports, but they utilize credit reports. So they are exempt both under the adult freezes and with this section under minor and incapacitated. And then lastly, in this section, there is a definition of a consumer credit reporting agency. And this definition includes the exemptions that are listed in the prior section. Section 3 is the last section of the bill. It's a transaction language that says that a freeze that is placed before the enactment of this statute, the conditions of that freeze will remain the old statute. And that's the bill.
Thank you very much. You went without a hitch, your entrance into the 21st century, right, with the PowerPoint. Thank you, Reneva. Are there questions from committee members? Senator Meyer?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I think Reneva did a good job of explaining the bill. I do believe, though, some states have said under 18. I noticed you went with 16, and you gave pretty good rationale for that. So I guess that's just something we can discuss as a policy call.
Absolutely.
Because as you know, 18 is the legal age before you kind of, in theory anyway, go from a child to an adult. So maybe you can help me out. Do all the provisions stay the same that we passed last year with the exception of, this bill seems to be just solely aimed at minors and incapacitated persons. Is that correct?
Chair,
everything else,
correct?
Everything else is the same? Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Senator Gardner?
Thank you. Very nice presentation with the visuals. Very good. If a parent puts a freeze on sort of for all their children and the children reach 16, they have to go through this potentially 30-day process to remove the freeze from their own record when they're of age to do so?
Through the chair, Senator Gardner, I believe the answer to that question is if they turn 16, they would be allowed to remove a freeze. But I also have, I believe, online my lifeline. Another time zone.
We have two individuals online that I was going to allow them to provide comments. So they're here listening, and so when they have a chance to provide that perhaps they could address that question.
Thank you.
Okay. Any further questions? Good. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So I'd like to open public testimony on Senate Bill 93 and invite Eric Ellman with the Consumer Data Association to provide your testimony.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for allowing me to testify. My name is Eric Ellman. with the Consumer Data Industry Association, CDIA, from Washington, D.C., and I'm flattered. I've never been called a lifeline before, so I'm going to have to use that in the future. So thank you, Reneva, for that. I thought Reneva did a really good job in kind of teeing up the issue here. We represent, CDI represents, about 120, 130 consumer reporting agencies, including the three major credit bureaus, Equifax, Experian, and TransUnion, who are obviously the most well-known of our members. We have worked closely with legislators in 26, 27 other states to help them pass these credit freezes for minors. The bill here in front of you, at its core, makes Alaska law consistent with the 26, 27 or so other states that have a minor credit freeze. To address a couple of the points that were raised by some of the questions, 18 versus 16, with due respect to the senator posing the question, all of the minor freeze statutes, 27 of them or so, all apply to below 16. There are no minor freeze laws that I'm aware of that apply to 16 or over. And again, as was pointed out earlier, the method to picking 16 in more than half of the states at this point is because when somebody turns 16, they will often get a job after school or summer job. They get cell phones. They become authorized users on their parents' credit cards. I don't know what the law is in Alaska, but in many other states, they are legally allowed to drop out of school. They can open checking accounts, and they become essentially credit active consumers. So that's why we are asking for the Alaska bill to follow what the other states have done and adopt a 16 rather than 18. The second question was on how or when can this be removed once the minor turns 16. And the answer there is once the minor turns 16, the minor is eligible to come to the consumer reporting agencies, the credit bureaus, and affirmatively request and be granted for that freeze to be removed. I think that staff did such an excellent job at presenting. I don't think I have anything else to add other than just to point out again that this would make Alaska law consistent with more than half of the states that have acted in this area. And I'm happy to answer any questions that any of you may have. And with that, I'll thank you for your time, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Ellman. Committee members, do you have questions? Senator Meyer?
Yeah, thank you. And thank you for that testimony. I guess I'm still kind of hung up, and maybe you can help me here on 18 versus 16. Or, in fact, I thought I saw some states just said anybody under 18. A parent or guardian is legally responsible for their child under age 18. So that's why I'm stuck on 18, I guess. Maybe you can tell me again why it's important.
Let me try to answer it this way. We in the credit reporting community and in the banking and financial services community, and I assume schools across your state and parents in general, to seek out and to educate as best as we collectively and individually can credit education for our youngsters, teaching them the responsibilities of managing their credit, of managing their financial well-being, and others. And while, yes, it is true that between the ages of 16 and 18, a parent or guardian might have to step in financially if the kid fails, that is really a matter between the parent and the minor and between the financial service grant or the business granting the service, whether it be a cell phone or a checking account or a debit card or things like that. So I think that's handled in a number of different ways, but I don't think the appropriate way to handle that is through this minor freeze. So the goal here with 16 and under is to assist consumers who we know for sure should not be credit active. But once you reach the age of 16, many consumers will become credit active, and we want to meet their needs, and we want to meet their parents' needs, because there's plenty of parents who would encourage their kids to go out and get a job and open a checking account and get some financial responsibility as they that they can learn to take forward later in life.
Senator Meyer.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. So I'm just trying to visualize. I have if I had a 17-year-old, and I do, do I want her to be credit active? Because I am responsible for her, but I guess she's not able to get a credit card on her own at age 17. What you're saying is that she is able to get a job, and that help that starts establishing the credit record. But as far as taking out loans or anything that a parent could be responsible for someone under 18, they can't do. Is that correct? I know I'm getting into legal matters now.
Well, Senator, let me try to answer it this way if I can. First, two things. First, keep in mind that for the minor freeze and the adult freeze do two different things. The minor freeze is, in the goal of the minor freeze is to prevent commerce from occurring. The adult freeze essentially empowers the consumer to use his or her credit like a light switch to turn it on or off when their credit needs need to be or met, or when they don't feel like they need credit needs to be met. So for 17-year-olds, your daughter or anyone else for that matter, if in fact they have a credit, if in fact they get a credit report because they have taken out a debit card or they become an authorized user on a parent's credit card, or they have a checking account or a cell phone, all of which will often come with a credit check, that consumer is now becomes essentially an adult consumer with an adult credit report, and they could take advantage of the adult freeze to shut down access to their credit report as they progress. The minor freeze prevents a credit report from being created in the first place. The adult freeze is available to consumers who want to freeze a file that comes into being.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Mr. Ellman, this is Senator Costello. So if you have this freeze on a minor's credit and somebody steals that individual's identity and attempts to start, you know, amassing a credit card debt, is there a way to communicate with that minor's parent?
Oh, yes, absolutely. First of all, let me back up a step and say that our members do not knowingly create credit reports for minors in the first place. So 99% or more of all minors do not and should not have a credit report. So if a minor has a credit report, and when I say minor, I mean under 16 for purposes of this legislation. So if a minor has a credit report, it is most certainly because of fraud. Unfortunately, it is a sad fact, as borne out by data from the Federal Trade Commission, that about one-third to one-half of all identity theft committed against a kid is committed by a parent, foster parent, guardian, or somebody with close connection to the family. That's just a sad state of facts. So for about a third to a half of all minors, this bill won't do anything to protect them. But for the two-thirds to other half, this bill can, in fact, be helpful. If a minor has a credit report created, probably because of fraud, this bill will allow, and the adult freeze will also be advantageous, will allow a consumer, a parent or guardian, to lock down the kid's credit history, and there are other procedures in place that will allow a parent or guardian to come to a credit bureau and check on activity or not on the credit report and monitor activity on a credit report as well.
Thank you. Any further questions? Okay, seeing none. Thank you very much. Next, we have Carly Christensen calling in from Atlanta, Georgia, with Equifax. Carly, if you could provide your testimony on the bill.
Hi, can you hear me all right?
Yes, we can.
Great. Again, I'm Carly Christensen testifying on behalf of Equifax, which is one of the nationwide credit reporting agencies, in support of SB 93. I'm a director of government relations I want to thank the chair and the committee for the opportunity to testify. And as has been discussed, I think, very well by Eric and the sponsor staff, SB 93 would be amending the Alaska law to bring it more in line with minor free laws across the country, and really specifying the manner in which a protected consumer's representative must submit a request to either place or remove a security freeze, and by specifying the sufficient proof of identification and authority to act on behalf of the protected consumer. The existing statute isn't that specific, and so by incorporating these requirements, the affected consumers will be more protected from the risk of a freeze being unduly placed or removed on their file. And then also, going back to the age as well, we support changing the age from 18 to 16 as someone who turns 16 becomes credit active, treating them as an adult as as they would be enabled to start to build their credit if they have a cell phone or a debit card. By incorporating these different amendments to the existing law, we'll bring it more in line with other laws across the country. So I also, Equifax submitted a letter for the record indicating our support as well, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Are there any questions that committee members have? Senator Gardner.
Thank you, and thank you for your testimony, Carly. Do you know if this tool of putting a credit freeze on the record of a minor has ever been used by dueling parents? I mean, what if one parent wants it and then is worried about the other parent misusing it?
Mm-hmm. I'm not aware of any specific instances offhand, but I'm happy to discuss that with our operations folks and see. I'm sure we've got a procedure in place to deal with that. I haven't dealt with that specifically. I don't know, Eric, if you're still on the line or if you've had any specific instances where you've heard about how that's dealt with generally.
Mr. Elman?
Thank you. Can I, Madam Chair, do you want me to try to answer that question as well?
If you could, please.
Sure. Eric Elman again from CDEIA. Senator, I don't necessarily have a good answer to that question, but we can try to research that. But what I can tell you is that one of the challenges that we have had or that we have with this still relatively new 4, 5, 6-year-old line of statutes is that unlike the adult freeze where we have where we deal with the customers, with adult consumers directly, minors injects a new layer of complexity because we have to look at paperwork from parents or guardians and look at paperwork to prove the identity of the kid and the relationship between the two of them. So it does pose additional challenges for us. And I suspect there are cases where we have to wind up in a position to arbitrate between dueling parents, which is certainly a difficult position at best. But it is a challenge. The reason that this bill is long and complicated is because this is a long and complicated process and system. It's a long answer to your short question, but we'll take a look into it and see if we can provide you with any information. But it does highlight some of the complexities that we deal with.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Gardner.
Thank you. And I realize that in the real world, this could be both a bug and a feature, as they say in the computer science world, you know, that some parents may very much want to do it to protect their kids from the other parent, and at the same time, it could be a problem.
Thank you very much. Is there anyone here in Juneau who wishes to testify on Senate Bill 93? Okay, is there anyone online? Okay, seeing none, public testimony is now closed on Senate Bill 93, and we will set this bill aside for further review. Thank you, Aniva. Next on our agenda is Senate Bill 38. This bill has been introduced by Senator Giesel. Welcome. It relates to the registration and duties of pharmacy benefit managers. Welcome, Jane. And this is the bill's first hearing. The intent is to hear from the sponsor, to take questions from the committee members. We have numerous people here to provide public testimony, and if you haven't signed in, I'd please encourage you to sign in, and then we will set the bill aside for further review. And also from the administration, We have Lori Winghire, who's the Director of the Division of Insurance. And with that, I'd like to turn it over to welcome Senator Giesel and staff Jane. Please feel free to present the bill to us.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, I'm Kathy Giesel, State Senator for District N in Anchorage. Madam Chair, as you said, Senate Bill 38 is about pharmacy benefits managers. It covers three elements that this committee should be, I know is, critically interested in. Number one, the cost of health care in Alaska. Number two, Alaska Hire. And number three, Alaska's small businesses, which are the foundation of our economy. Madam Chair, before I go any further, I want to make note that we are joined today by a group of very special young people. They're wearing white coats, and in fact, I would ask them to stand up as well as their faculty member. These are pharmacy students from the University of Alaska Anchorage here with their instructor. This is a first class, I'm told, of pharmacy students, and I'm also told that they're all Alaskans. Well, so I'm
Senator
very pleased
Giesel,
they could be here.
Thank you for having them here, and welcome to the committee.
So going on, if pharmacy benefit managers, you know, a picture is worth a thousand words, and this document should be in your packet somewhere. Oh, I think my staff is going to have your staff hand it out. But this graphic will help you in understanding that these pharmacy benefit managers are the middlemen between the insurance company that provides you with insurance coverage for your medications and the pharmacy itself. So these are the middlemen. On the left-hand side, you see the payer. That's your insurance company. And let's say that you go in to pick up a prescription, and that prescription is $100. So you see there, the payer is going to pay $100 for that prescription for you. Well, the benefit manager is in the middle. This is a company. These are companies. There are several of them, very, very large ones. Express Scripts is one. There are several, and you'll hear about more of them. But they're the middlemen, and they're hired by the insurance company to manage the prescription benefits that they offer to you. So they take a cut out of every prescription. And then over here on the far right-hand side is our pharmacies. These can be large pharmacies, but in Alaska, we have a lot of small businesses that are pharmacies in small communities. So here's that $100 prescription. Here's the pharmacy over here on the other side, and they paid $60 for that prescription. But the insurance company was charged $100 for that same prescription. $50 of it is captured in the middle by the pharmacy benefit managers. And the pharmacy itself only ends up getting $50. They paid $60 for that prescription you picked up, but the PBM, the middleman, is only going to give them $50 of that $100 your insurance company paid for, and they're going to tell the pharmacy, you're going to have to pay for the other $10. That's on you. So that's the detrimental effects that these middle managers are having on our, first of all, healthcare costs, but secondarily, the small businesses that we call pharmacies in our state, the neighborhood pharmacies. They also, these PBMs, also audit our pharmacies and make some pretty egregious fines and very minor clerical errors can result in significant fines for these small businesses, these pharmacies. So you will see that the bill is offered by me by the request of my healthcare colleagues, the pharmacists. Many of our local pharmacies have actually gone out of business. Many of these PBMs are now coming under investigation, and you will see in your articles, in the packet, several articles that they're short reads, easy to read, and will help you understand. One of them from Newsweek, just March 17th, so that was last week, Understanding the Hidden Villain of Big Pharma, Pharmacy Benefit Managers. There's another article from Bloomberg earlier in March, Drug Costs Too High, Fire the Middleman. Again, an article about PBMs. So The bill will allow the state of Alaska to actually license the PBMs to begin with and also constrain the minor technical errors they find as they do these audits and actually help support our small businesses of local pharmacies. Madam Chair, I'm not going to spend a lot more time because there's a lot of information to help you understand this particular entity in our healthcare system, but we also have pharmacists who have traveled here and I know would like to speak to you today. So I'll end with that. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Giesel. Senator Stevens.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So are these PBM is in every situation in Alaska, or are there some agencies that avoid them?
Senator Stevens, through the chair, PBMs work for insurance companies. So we have Aetna, for example, and Aetna uses a PBM. Interestingly, the PBM that Aetna uses will not allow you and I to order our prescriptions by mail order from a local Alaska pharmacy. It requires that we order from pharmacies that are out of state. So if we lived in Unalaska, let's say, and there was no pharmacy there and we needed to mail order our prescription and we wanted to order from, oh, a pharmacy in Anchorage, we would not be allowed to do that. We would have to order our prescription from a pharmacy in the lower 48 that the PBM contracts with.
Senator Stevens?
No, I think I understand that. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Gardner.
Thank you. I'll pass.
Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Senator Giesel. So is this legislation that is similar, that is used in other states?
It is. Actually, you have a map in your packet also. And let me see if I can find it.
I saw.
You saw the map. Yeah. Okay, yes. Is it 37 states, I believe, something like that, have actually passed very similar legislation to this?
Yeah, I guess my question is it saving money for the consumers?
I'm going to have my aide, Jane, respond.
This is Jane Conway, staff to Senator Kathy Giesel. I'm going to answer that in the negative, in that there are claims that this will increase healthcare costs, and we are not able to find data to substantiate that claim that it has increased healthcare costs, but it may have assisted in many local pharmacies staying afloat.
Okay, good. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Gardner.
Thank you. I have my question better formed now. And it has to do with the audits and the timelines and the notifications and that kind of thing. And I believe that we've had such bills before. Your approach is slightly different because I think the pharmacists before, I don't remember them being on the floor, but I remember talking with these people in my office and what they described the problems that they had about the timing and the length of time and the costs of the PBM audit. So that's part of your bill also, right? Okay. So it is the same thing I'm talking about, and I thought to myself, these poor guys, they never get it through, and they keep trying and trying. And it makes sense to me, so.
Yes, Senator Gardner, through the chair, this is not the first time the bill has been offered. It's the second time for me, and I believe it's been offered prior to that by other legislators. And the details about the audit time lengths and so forth are best answered by the pharmacists who are here to speak to you.
Right.
Thank you.
Got it. Thank you.
Senator Giesel, thank you. So are the auditing practices that are used by the PBMs, or do they come from national standards or state standards? Are they behaving based off of guidelines that they are working under for some reason, or is it a haphazard way that they're going about?
Through the chair, Senator Costello. I think Jane Conway, for the record. I think that's one of the reasons why we have this bill, is because, by and large, the PBMs are unregulated. There are no real guidelines. And so established in the beginning to actually be a asset to insurers and trusts and unions and anybody who has or self-insured, they now have become more of a giant entity. And we find that there really isn't any regulation for the hows and whys that they ask for audits. And I guess that's the answer. There really isn't any regulation or sidebars on their procedures.
Thank you. And I'm aware of the role that they play in the auditing practice, but could you explain more fully how they're managing the prescriptions and the services? What role are they playing in that area as far as management?
Madam Chair, this is Senator Giesel. You know, that'll be best answered by the pharmacist who wished to speak to you, but essentially they're just making sure that the person is one of the insured, you know, that the quantity of the prescription, all of those kinds of things are appropriate. And when they go in and do the audits, they're checking to see if the pharmacy has charged the correct amount or if they've overcharged, but if there's been clerical errors, even a misspelled word, often is resulting in a fine. And so that's one of the things that we want to have regulated here. But the pharmacist can best answer their experiences with these audits.
And are you aware, do they have access to the prescription database that we've recently been hearing about?
Madam Chair, Senator Giesel again, specifically who is they?
The PBMs.
The PBMs. I couldn't answer that question. I am not sure, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you. Senator Hughes?
Yes, thank you. I saw someone back there shaking their head.
Right, but the audio visual doesn't include the public, and so shaking your head, everyone will have a chance to testify, and if there's anything you want to comment on, you'll have that opportunity. So, Senator Hughes.
I appreciate you bringing this bill forward, and we learn something every day in this legislature, certainly. And so this is a new area to me. I appreciate the visual. When I was going through the materials, I was a bit surprised to see that the state chamber had some reservations about the bill. But what I'm picking up on, based on what your staff, Jane, said, that the PBMs are large and they're not in-state entities, and we have a contract issue here. Have the pharmacists attempted to resolve some of these things working directly with the PBMs as far as the audits, but also in as far as the payment arrangement, where sometimes they're going in the hole to cover things? So have they attempted to take care of that in contracts and just been unsuccessful, and that's why you're coming to us? Because we've had a couple other bills that are similar to that in different industries.
But Senator Hughes, through the chair, yes, they have tried to resolve this, but the contracts are offered as a take it or leave it. In other words, there is no negotiation between the pharmacist, and the PBM. And yes, these are very large entities. They are typically Fortune 500 companies. Their CEOs are paid multi-million dollar salaries.
Follow-up?
Senator Hughes.
And have you had conversation with the state chamber then why they would take the position that they have? Because, as you said, small businesses are the backbone here in Alaska of our economy, so I'm just kind of confused to see that.
Senator Hughes, through the chair, my understanding is that the state chamber was wanting to see what Congress did with the Affordable Care Act and felt that that would have some ramifications. Since that didn't happen last week, I don't know if the chamber still holds those reservations.
Senator Hughes.
And do you happen to know, is there work on this particular issue related to PBMs underway in the bills in Congress related to changing the Affordable Care Act?
Through the chair, Senator Hughes, in its Jane Conway, in regard to the Affordable Care Act, I do not know, but I know that there's four pieces of legislation going through Congress that have been introduced that are trying to, like we are, shine a light on the activities of pharmacy benefit managers.
Thank you.
Senator Stevens.
So if this bill were to pass, how would it impact Aetna's activities the way they're acting right now? We're working through a PBM. Would this change that? So Aetna, I mean, does Aetna call the shots here?
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, Jane Conway. Well, you will see that in the packet there's a fiscal note from admin, and they are claiming that this could possibly increase costs. There's an indeterminate note on there. However, We do have a letter in your packet from Barry Christensen, who is a pharmacist out of Ketchikan, and he outlines some very good points in it on kind of just accentuating that, taking issue with many of the points in the Chamber's letter. So I hope that you would look at that, and because I don't think the pharmacists agree that this will actually be increasing costs or changing anything that Aetna is doing. However, there could be some good suggestions to our health plan that could help our local pharmacies rather than be to the detriment of them in terms of the mail order component.
Thank you, Jane. I guess our question is, how does this cause Aetna to act differently than it is now?
Senator Stevens, through the chair, this is Senator Giesel. You know, I think that would be a question to ask the pharmacists, who are much more, they have a working knowledge of how these work. But remember, Aetna hires the PBM. They're the middleman for the PBM. So Aetna will likely continue to have the PBM, but it's the conduct of that middleman that this bill addresses, not so much the existence of them, but their conduct.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Gardner.
I'm actually very shocked by this. When we talk about trying to find ways that we can reduce the cost of health care, it seems to me that for the PBM to get half of the retail value, and I don't know what pharmaceutical markups are for the retailer, but for most industries it's 10 to 20%. So, and somebody else is taking 50% of the retail right out of the middle. No wonder the consumers paying so much. It's just amazing. So I don't know if anybody will be testifying about why they should get so much when they're really auditors.
Thank you. And if individuals in the audience would like to carry on conversations, you're welcome to go into the hallway. Senator Gardner?
That's it. I guess I didn't really have a question. How can we allow this to go on?
Senator Giesel, would you like to respond to the comment?
Madam Chair, that's the point of the bill.
Okay. With that, I would like to invite Division Director Lori Winghire forward, if she's in the room. So, committee members, we have two fiscal notes, and we are not the Finance Committee, but I did want to mention that the Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development has a fiscal note, so does the Department of Administration. And on the first fiscal note, component number 354, it mentions the role of the Division Director of Insurance. So, Ms. Winghire, if you could just comment on what your role would be if this bill were to pass in terms of the appeal process or any procedures that are set out in the legislation?
Certainly. For the record, my name is Lori Winghire. I'm the director of the Division of Insurance for the state of Alaska. If the bill were to pass, the pharmacy benefit managers would enroll, or they would be required to register as a third-party administrator, which is already in the statute of the state of Alaska. So they would, much as a TPA or a third-party administrator, would be subject to that statute, and they would pay a biannual licensing fee so that we would know who they are, who is operating in the state, and they would be subject to the statutes as a TPA would. We would then be able to, if we had any consumer complaints, we would follow up with them knowing who they are, where they are, and their compliance officer. So we do not expect that it would be much of a burden on the state of Alaska, as one, we do not think there are many operating in the state at this time, and it's just a licensing or a registration matter at this point for the division, as respects the first part of the bill. Okay. In the auditing part, if there were to be any appeals, at this point we don't know how many appeals there would be, but as you've heard me speak before, we have a process set up for appeals, and we believe that we would handle it in accordance with established procedures already within the division.
And does the administration have a position on the bill?
The Division of Insurance looks at it as a process four that we can handle internally, and it's an addition to our statute, and we would take it accordingly. The position of the administration, of course, is the fiscal note the indeterminate fiscal note that I believe you have in your packet from the Department of Administration.
So usually, a fiscal note doesn't necessarily indicate a philosophical position. Are you aware if the administration is in support or not in support of the bill?
No, I'm not.
You're not aware. Okay. Are there any questions for Ms. Wingheyer? Senator Meyer?
Yeah, I think so, Madam Chair. And I'm still learning the whole process here and trying to figure out why the middleman, but it sounds like our own insurance, Aetna or Alaska Care, does use the PBM. Is that something we could require of Aetna not to do?
Through the chair, Senator Meyer, that would best be answered by retirement and benefits, who I know are in the room. This is as you look at the list of who they is in Senator Giesel's presentation, Express Scripts is Primera's PBM. Every insurance company has a pharmacy benefit manager that they use. And this bill is really about consumer protection, with the administration supports consumer protections. The first part of the bill, if I was to look at the bill in two parts, there's the consumer protection, the audit piece for the PBMs, and what I would consider, if you were to look for a word, it's the Fair Audit Act, because that's what it resembles to me. The second part of the bill then has to do with the pricing of the generic drugs and the impact that that would have on not just the State of Alaska plan, but any employer plan, large or small, and frankly, the individual market. That's where the bill, if you break it down into two pieces.
Okay, Madam Chair.
Senator Meyer.
So how many insurance companies are there in Alaska providing health insurance?
Through the chair, Senator Meyer, right now that are actually writing to the public, that aren't writing just like for ConocoPhillips or Fred Meyer or for one or two accounts, there's less than half a dozen.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Are there further questions? Senator Stevens.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just could you briefly tell us, what does the PBM do? We've talked about auditing. It looks from this chart that they submit the bill to the insurance company. They collect the money, and then they pass on a salary amount to the pharmacy. What exactly is their function?
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, when they're referred to as the middleman, they are negotiating the price from the wholesaler or the drug manufacturer to the pharmacist. And somewhere in the middle there is the insurance company. And that's where the methodology of the charge gets a little fuzzy to what the pharmacist is receiving. The PBM is actually paying, and what they are receiving, what they're paying the pharmacist and what they're receiving from the insurance company and what they're paying the wholesaler or the drug company itself.
Senator Stevens?
It's a shocking situation, but they do negotiate with the drug companies to hopefully lower the price, I would assume, and in the end might be of some benefit to the consumer.
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, that is correct. That is what their purpose is to obtain the best possible cost for the market so that the consumer, you and I, and the employer, if you're an employer-sponsored plan, has the benefit of the lowest cost.
Thank you.
Senator Gardner?
Thank you. But if they get 50% of whatever the cost is, don't they have a sort of perverse incentive to not negotiate very low?
Through the chair, Senator Gardner, rebates in pharmaceuticals are a topic unto itself. It's not just pharmaceuticals or PBMs where rebates are. They're within pharmaceuticals throughout the chain, from providers to PBMs to the insurance companies themselves. If you were to care to take a look at the regulation we passed on the reinsurance bill last year, you will see where we specifically carved out all rebates because it's state money. but it's not just in this one particular instance. Rebates are common in pharmaceuticals, unfortunately.
Thank you.
Ms. Wingheyer, are you aware of other states having legislation similar to this, specifically in regards to the role that the Division of Insurance has in this bill?
Chairman Costello, I know that there are fair audit acts in quite a few states, and to the best of my knowledge, they rely in the Division of Insurance. If they're not within insurance, then they're in licensing.
Okay. Thank you. Any further questions of committee members? Next, I'd like to invite Michelle Michaud and Emily Rieke up from the Division of Retirement and Benefits, because we had a question, I think, Senator Gardner, that was related to the Division of Retirement and Benefits.
Really?
Do you remember your question?
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Emily Ricci. I am Chief Health Policy Administrator in the Division of Retirement and Benefits.
And I am Michelle Michaud. I'm the Chief Health Official for the Division of Retirement and Benefits.
Was there any comment that you wanted to make on the bill or any questions that you heard that you wanted to reply to as you heard the committee?
No.
Okay. Senator Meyer?
Yeah, I think I had the question. But oh. If Senator Gardner wants to ask a question. I guess my question was, we use Alaska Care or Aetna as our provider, and if we were to ask them not to go through a PDM, you know, I guess there's some question as to we get a better rate if we do go through the PDM or if we don't. But certainly, I think there's some concern about the smaller pharmacy, Alaska Pharmacy. Is that something we can do?
Through the chair, Senator Meyer, we would probably have to consult with Department of Law and make sure that this is something that we could do with the existing agreement that we have with Aetna. But I think beyond that, it would require significant analysis to see if that would be in the best interest of the plan.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Stevens.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Could you just give us a ballpark figure? How much money does the retirement, our retirement programs pay in pharmacy benefits a year?
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, generics I have off the top of my head, we spent $55 million in generic medication last year. I want to say that overall our pharmacy spend was closer to $300
million. Senator Stevens?
That would balance our budget right there. Thank you.
No more medication.
Emily, do you have a comment to that?
I do. Through the chair, Senator Stevens and Senator Meyer, you know, I would have to look back to find out when the state health plans started adopting PBMs to manage their pharmacy benefits. But it's a very common practice among large employers. I want to say a couple of years ago, I went to look at what other options last time the state went out to bid for third-party administrator services for the health plan. I just wanted to see if there were other options that were utilized by large employers kind of in the United States as just to make sure we're covering all the bases in terms of exploring what our options are for pharmacy benefit management. And I didn't find anything that would provide kind of the level of savings and kind of comprehensive package of services that the PBM industry applies. Just to put this into perspective, I mean, we have a dedicated team of 8 in the Division of Retirement and Benefits, and so we rely heavily on our contractors and our third-party administrators to manage the, you know, 200, what number did you just give? $300 million pharmacy spend on top of the medical spend. Mm. And so I guess my point is that it is not There's not an easy alternative to moving away from using a pharmacy benefit managers to manage the pharmacy spend. In fact, there aren't alternatives I'm aware of that are widely used by any sort of third-party administrators or large employer health plans.
Senator Gardner?
Thank you. And is a 50% cut standard among pharmacy benefit plans?
Through the chair, Senator Gardner, I'm not sure. That's a better question for Aetna, our pharmacy benefit manager, or some of the other kind of pharmaceutical experts in the room.
Thank you.
Senator Gardner, we do have some pharmacy benefit managers online, and it's my intention to go to the public testimony section of the hearing, and I will be asking those testifying to keep your comments to 2 minutes out of respect, not only for the committee, we will be ending at 3:30, but more so for the Alaskans who are both here and also online waiting to testify. So are there any further questions? Thank you so much for being here, for hearing the bill, and for answering the questions. So next I will open up public testimony on Senate Bill 38. I'll start here in the room with Leif Holm. I will then go online to Anchorage to hear from Matthew Keith, and then I'll return back to Juneau and then continue down the list. Just wanted to mention, if you could keep your comments to 2 minutes so that everybody who's online can have an opportunity to testify. Thank you very much, and please feel free to introduce yourself to the committee.
Sure. Thank you for having me. My name is Leif Holm. I'm from North Pole, Alaska, and I'm an independent pharmacy owner of three different pharmacies in the interior of Alaska. So in the interest of keeping, this is a day-long discussion, I feel like, especially with all the questions, which I would love to answer, but I prepared a statement to keep it short, so I'll go on with it. With this start in regulating PBMs, the goal is their deceptive tactics will become transparent and will no longer be business as usual for them in Alaska. This legislation will begin to put an end to practices such as product steering to costly rebated medications, spread pricing, charging health plans more than they pay the pharmacy, misclassification of brand and generic drugs for the purpose of favorably modifying their branded rebates or their generic substitution percentage, mail order requirements, and much costlier health care due to product steering and waste, and abusive audit practices, which we're discussing, which financially punish pharmacies for clerical errors that have no effect on cost or quality of care. My pharmacies in particular are currently most affected by the MAC pricing issues this bill looks to correct, taking losses on roughly 10% of the prescriptions that we dispense on a daily basis and climbing every year. It could be upwards of $1,000 a week that I lose between my three pharmacies, which is pretty substantial. Regulating audit practices and correcting pricing strategies is a step in the right direction to ultimately achieve transparency with these PBMs. It's the right thing to do to rein them in and begin to eliminate their abusive tactics that ultimately cost health plan sponsors money and patients quality care. I strongly support the passage of SB 38. It is long overdue.
Thank you, Leif, and I do want to let you know and those listening that you're more than welcome to provide any written testimony, or if there are questions that were asked that you would like to respond to in writing, that would be more than welcome by the committee.
There's a plethora of questions, so to remember them all would probably be too much, but if anybody has questions, again, I would love to answer them.
Senator Stevens.
Thank you. Real briefly, I appreciate hearing about the, not now, but sometime later from you on abusive audit practices.
Sure.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next, Matthew Keith, the Vice President for the Geneva Woods Pharmacy in Anchorage. Please feel free to provide your testimony, Matthew.
Thank you for the time and the moment, Madam Chair. Geneva Woods is also a small, independently owned pharmacy and home medical company that's been in Alaska for nearly 40 years and constantly under a struggle from the types of problems and abusive audit practices that Leif very articulately explained. In kind of simple terms, the state regulates pharmacies, medical practices, wholesalers, insurance providers. Would it not make sense for them to also regulate the PBM in the middle? This is not about eliminating PBMs. I fully understand that they're here to stay and that insurance companies rarely have the internal expertise to do the things that I think are valuable components of what a PBM does. But what this does is put guardrails on those PBMs so that what happens is more of a reasonableness than what we currently see. There's been discussions about whether or not there's a negotiated relationship and that that's really an all or none, and I would argue that's exactly what it is. Kind of in fair trade, you would assume that in that relationship both persons would have the ability to negotiate equally and fairly, but we're, as pharmacies, more like ants negotiating with aardvarks, and it's not a fair and equitable circumstance. In the end, you also need to remember that many PBMs own mail order pharmacies. And so is the intent here to drive the rest of us out of business so that they can push that business to their own pharmacies? And so there also are other concerns that have been raised in the news in in the articles about some of these conducts. So also being fair about time, that's all I have to share for the moment.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your testimony. Next, I'll go to Scott Watt here in the room, followed by Gerald Cusbrown. Welcome, Scott.
Hi. Thank you. My name is Scott Watts. I'm a Juneau resident, been here for 27 years practicing pharmacy that entire time. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members for the time. A couple things that I bring up. I'd like to also mention the MAC price listing that daily we're dispensing medications that are below our cost. And yes, if we could negotiate or talk with these PBMs, that is probably the best way to do it. But most of the time, these departments do not have a phone number. We are left in a phone tree maze, wasted time and effort, no result. In the meantime, the patient is getting those medications, but we are not getting reimbursed. It is very difficult, as has been stated before. These lists are a way to keep costs down, but they need to be updated. When the cost of the drug goes up, that list needs to be raised also. It should not be borne on the backs of the pharmacist to keep those prices down if we have to pay higher prices. The mail order has been mentioned. We have a lot of customers that come in from nearby Hoonah, Gustavus. Those are not very far away. They come to Juneau for their health care. They stop and see us, pick up prescriptions. When they're not in town, they would like their prescriptions mailed out. That, according to some contracts, is a breach of contract and needs to be done through their mail order pharmacy, which is out of state, and it's not convenient for these customers, patients. One quick example I had with on the pricing issues was a copay didn't match up for a customer. They thought their copay should be lower. The pricing is set by these PBMs when we transmit the prescription, so I directed them to their health care plan. That got a prompt response. That afternoon, I got a phone call from the PBM saying that we were in breach of contract because we were telling the customer what the plan was paying for their prescription. We were not to let the customer know what the cost of the prescription was. We were just to give them the copay, and that's it. So I'm not sure why they don't want the price of the medication to be aware of with the customers, but we can take from there. But anyway, I feel they should know what the cost of their medications are. Brevity, that's my testimony at this point. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. And if you would, if you wish to provide any testimony in writing, the committee would be open to that, too.
Okay. Thank you.
We'd like to. Next, Gerald Cusbrown, welcome. Please feel free to provide your testimony to the committee.
My name is Gerald Brown. I'm an independent pharmacy owner with my wife in Fairbanks. We own a very small pharmacy. We are also experiencing many of these things where the MAC prices are such that they set them, but price increases don't get reflected for anywhere from 6 months to a year. And so consequently, we're constantly being under-reimbursed, probably over $1,000 for our pharmacy per month. And for a large chain in town, I know that they've been up to $30,000 a month under reimbursed. So this is a prevalent problem with PBMs. PBMs, just to let you know, and this could be a long discussion, but I'll try and make it brief, are kind of like your credit card if you're having confusion as to how that works. But it's Alaska Airlines that sponsors the card, and the Visa card is the people that administer that benefit to you. And it's a Visa card that is now saying, you get a copay of this amount or we pay this amount. The problem is that the pharmacies are getting about 45 cents plus a 21% less than costs and 45 cents to dispense it, which makes it so that it's almost impossible to there's no profit. If you ever took that business model to the bank, you could not get a business license for that because they'd say, how are you making money there? So this is really important. This also doesn't tell you that you were asking about the 50%. Well, the general range of those rebates are 30 to 60%. And those are being given back as rebates from the manufacturer or the pharmaceutical companies to the PBMs to give them a better deal. And so now your formulators are based not on therapeutics, but they're based on who gives us the bigger rebates. And the pharmacies never see that because we don't get to share. They just tell us how much they're going to get we're going to get reimbursed, and the cost that we receive may not reflect the cost we actually paid at the wholesaler. But the PBMs are making a lot of money. Realize that the CEOs for these PBMs last year got between $9 and $49 million bonuses. So they're not losing money, and so they can certainly afford to do that. In the state of Alaska, you were talking about who the PBMs represent. Your state insurance commissioner just said about a half a dozen people, but realize that over 50% of the insured here in the state of Alaska are not state insured insurance companies, but ERISA companies who don't fall under state insurance rules, but fall under federal rules, which have no rules and regulations. And so all we're asking in this bill is to please try to give us some structure so that it gives the PBM structure so that when they come in and like with contracts, it's a take it or leave it situation. They don't come in and just squash people like myself who are very small and don't have the capacity, and we can't, they're extrapolating errors by tens and thousands of times, hundreds of times over what they find in their audits. We're just asking for them to be considerate when they come in and audits. We don't have problems with the audits. We have problems with the take-it-or-leave-it attitude and we're the big insurance companies. And these are guys from out the state. They're not here in the state. We're asking to have them at least register with the state.
Thank you very much, Mr. Brown. Appreciate it. Senator Gardner.
So you've identified a couple of problems that I hadn't really, we hadn't had testimony on yet today. One of them is that the back prices are set, but the increases to you don't follow at the same time. And the other is that formulas can be based on who gives the biggest rebates.
Exactly.
Does this bill address either of those issues?
No, it doesn't.
Thank you.
It doesn't.
Thank you very much. Next, Shannon Butler with Aetna, calling in from Phoenix, Arizona. I do want to mention that we do have 10 minutes left in the committee, and members need to be out of here to attend other committee meetings, so please keep that in mind. Welcome, Shannon.
Hi, good afternoon, Madam Chair. Actually, if possible, I would like to allow one of the PBMs to go ahead and testify first to answer some of your questions that have been raised, and then I'm happy to testify after that.
Thank you, Ms. Butler. I don't have that list in front of me. I just have names of individuals. Eric Douglas with CVS Health, if you'd like to testify next.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
Hi, this is Eric Douglas with CVS Health. Thank you, Senator. I'm calling in today because we're concerned about SB 38. I'll be very brief with my comments, and then you can ask me some questions. It sounds like many of the comments have gotten way off of what the bill even addresses, and PBMs have been portrayed as something that they're not. Well, I'll just start by saying PBMs save money. If they did not save money, including the state of Alaska money, they wouldn't be hired, and they wouldn't be utilized, or they wouldn't be in existence. So having said that, we're concerned that SB 38 would unintentionally promote fraud, waste, and abuse because it inserts the state into private audit terms that are already well addressed via contract today. SB 38 also inappropriately charges the director of the Alaska Department of Insurance to be the arbiter of private contract disputes for which the department does not have expertise regarding generic pharmaceutical reimbursement. The bill also sets up some things that are impossible to do. For example, ensuring that a specific pharmacy can buy a specific product at a specific wholesaler for a specific price is not something that a PBM can do. In fact, no one can do. It sets up the way it increased costs is, aside from the unintended consequences it could have with respect to audit, but the other way it increased costs is because it sets up a de facto no-loss guarantee on MAC, which are generic drug reimbursements. And because generic drugs are a commodity, once that fact is known,
there's no downward cost pressure to keep wholesalers from increasing prices and for generic drugs to artificially inflate in the state of Alaska. And then finally, just a question, maybe it's a drafting question, but notice that the Board of Pharmacy is defined in the definitions, yet they're not used in the legislation at all, and thought that was curious. Is we would have concerns with the Board of Pharmacy having anything to do with PBMs, as there is a financial relationship between pharmacy benefit managers and pharmacies. And with that, thank you.
Thank you very much. Next, I'd like to invite Tom Wadsworth, who's in the room, who's the UAA professor.
Thank you, Madam Chair and the committee. I'll keep my remarks brief. I wanted to introduce you to our students. We have a Doctor of Pharmacy program at UAA. I'm the assistant dean of the program. These are Alaskans. And the founding principles of this program is to train Alaskans in Alaska so that they go into the rural areas of Alaska to serve Alaskans. I'm in support of SB 38 because the single biggest issue with sending these students into rural areas is that there won't be pharmacies to go to. These brick-and-mortar pharmacies are... Pharmacists see the patient seven times more often than a physician. And I think it should be noted that pharmacists in the communities do not receive significant reimbursement for cognitive services. They make their money by selling prescriptions. And as the profit margins have shrunk, the sustainability of these small community pharmacies, which have served the public selflessly for many years, is becoming increasingly difficult. And instead of seeing these pharmacies change hands to these bright and new Doctor of Pharmacy students, these pharmacies are closing, and or they're selling to bigger stores, which then close their doors. They sell their prescriptions. So we're in support of this. I think PBMs serve a wonderful role in controlling in formularies and drug costs, but it's a shuffle of money. They are saving money, but the money is going from one pot to another. And we need to see that pharmacists are reimbursed for what they do for these communities so that they can be there to serve the patients of these communities, particularly rural Alaska.
Thank you, and I'm not sure if you're aware this committee is the only committee in the legislature with a Facebook page, and I do an interview after most of the meetings. Would like to invite the students to talk about that following the meeting, so if you could stick around. I think that's an important message to get out, that we need more Alaska, born and raised pharmacists here in our state, so I want to just offer that comment to you. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Next, Barry Christensen calling in from Ketchikan with the Alaska Pharmacists Association. Barry, if you could provide your testimony.
Yes, hi, thank you. This is Barry Christensen. I'm a practicing pharmacist in Ketchikan. Actually, I'm one of those small pharmacies in rural Alaska that Dr. Wadsworth just mentioned. My dad, actually, had a funeral with my dad. He's pharmacist license number 67 in the state of Alaska. Our pharmacy has been in operation for 43 years. The passage of Senate Bill 38 is important and necessary for Alaska pharmacies like ours to remain viable. I know that that there's questions. Senator Stevens had one like an example of an audit abuse practice, and my letter is, I believe, in your packet, but I'm going to go ahead and read the description of audit abuse. It won't take too long here. We received a large desk audit from a PBM which generated over 100 pages of documentation. Our two choices of transmission for the material was either unsecured email or fax. Naturally, we chose fax, since our fax machine will only hold or send 50 faxes at a time, we had to send two separate faxes, which was so noted on our cover letters and also in our email notice to the auditor. Imagine our surprise when we got our audit results, which showed that they didn't include half the documentation. When we contacted the auditor, they claimed they never received the second fax, even though we had confirmation that the fax went through. They did allow us to resend the fax again. However, they only allowed a five-day period on the final audit findings for appeal. This included a $400 claim for a prescription that wasn't even present in the audit prescription claims that were sent to us. The auditor claimed that they randomly select claims to send to prescribers to verify. In this case, we checked with the prescriber's office, and they had no documentation asking to verify the prescription, but they were willing to write a letter on our behalf indicating the validity of that prescription and two others that were, quote, deemed not verified. In this case, we received the final audit notice document from the PBM on a Thursday afternoon and were told any additional documentation needed to reach their office in the Midwest by the following Tuesday by mail. This meant we had less than 24 hours to get our documents and the letter from the prescriber mentioned above in the mail so it would reach them. We do not believe this was a fair submission turnaround time, and quite frankly, it was a miracle that we were able to respond in time. Senate Bill 38 set standards, and that's all we're asking for in this bill, and I urge you your support of it. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Next, Fred Brown, calling in from Fairbanks with the Healthcare Cost Management Corporation of Alaska.
For the record, my name is Fred Brown. Thank you, Senator. My address is 1469 Holy Cross Drive, Fairbanks, Alaska, 99709. I did submit a letter, and I won't reiterate the points included therein, given the interest of time, but I will respond to a few of the comments that were made earlier. Our organization has over 100,000 covered lives in Alaska. It's comprised of about 25 or more self-funded plans, many Taft-Hartley funds and others. We offer a myriad of various options for our member plans to use or select, and among them is access to prescription benefit management. Not all of our plans in Alaska use them, but 13 do use the prescription benefit management program that we offer. And of those 13, the total drug valuation, the gross value is $74.1 million in 2016. I was very interested to hear the repeated comments earlier about how 50% of that goes to the PBM. The fact of the matter is that in 2016, our plans saved 49% of that total, or about $37.8 million. So if the earlier descriptions are correct, then the PBM only made 1%. And I'm sure there's more to the story than I've described. But the point I'm making here is, and there's many other points I could make, but given the fact I only have 2 minutes, I want to emphasize that there's much more to the story than you've heard thus far. Thank you.
Thank you. And I want to thank those who were waiting online and those who testified and came here today. We will be adjourning the committee. We will keep the public testimony open. So for those of you who wish to testify, my aide will be in touch with you. I can see your names here on the list. There's just a few of you. And with that, the meeting is adjourned.